Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, Head of Outreach and Governance.
This is Alicia García Herrero, I'm Bruegel Fellow.
And today we are pleased to virtually host Yiping Huang from Peking University. Yiping is a Jinhuang Chair Professor of Economics and Finance and Deputy Dean at the National School of Development and Director at the Institute of Digital Finance at the Peking University. Ni hao, Professor Yiping Huang.
Hello. Well, thanks for having me.
Yiping, where are you now? Are you in the Peking University or working from home?
Well, I work at the Peking University, but I came back on the Chinese New Year's Day to Hong Kong, directly from Davos. Unfortunately, I've been stuck here. Although I'm still in the process of teaching a course at the university. So all of our students are still at home at the moment, but the teaching has been going on.
Okay, and Alicia also is in Hong Kong, joining us remotely. So we are having a very Asian hosting today and guests. So me and Professor Yiping and Alicia will explore in this episode the short and medium-term prospects for the Chinese economy after the COVID-19 pandemic. So let me introduce a little bit what I understand is the situation of the Chinese economy at the moment. China's GDP in the first quarter of the year experienced a 6.8 negative growth. And the outbreak of the coronavirus particularly hit the local retail sales and fixed asset investment. On the trade front, export growth in March was negative, but less than that of domestic retail sales. So the vanishing domestic demand is happening in conjunction with the rapidly worsening labor market in terms of higher unemployment rate and collapsing of disposable income. Additionally, the pandemic, it seems that will unavoidably affect the external demand in the first half of the year. So, to fight against the economic pressure, more fiscal and monetary stimulus have embarked. The People's Bank of China has cut the one-year medium-term lending facility rate twice and lowered the reserve requirement ratio for the medium and small banks also twice. So the laxer financial conditions was reflected in the rapid growth in M2 and total social financing, with the latter pushed by higher bank loans and bond issuance. That said, the monetary transmission mechanism is still a concern as how to channel the liquidity to support the private and small enterprises which took a hard hit from the coronavirus shock. Okay, this is like some sort of attempt to describe the economic situation in this phase. However, I would like to ask Professor Yiping to walk us through the details and explain to our listeners from his perspective what is the economic outlook at the moment, its prospects, and in other words, how hard has the Chinese economy been hit by COVID-19?
Well, You mentioned China's GDP growth during the first quarter was negative 6.8%. Just to give you a comparison, at the height of the global financial crisis, when the economy was really hard hit, at the fourth quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009, our GDP growth was slightly above positive 6%. And at that time, we saw that it was devastating. So that gives you an idea how bad the situation was this year. But I think things look different. And the main reason why the economy suffered from a negative growth was basically because of the isolation or the lockdown of the cities. And a large part of the country basically almost stopped economic operation for about 4 to 6 weeks, and economic activities were seriously affected even as of now. So I think we're just gradually coming out of this control or lockdown, but my own expectation is we are expecting the economy to recover, but it probably will be a very slow process. And plus, there are lots of uncertainties around it. So for instance, one of the main drivers in the Chinese economy has been export growth. And that's why after the Chinese New Year, after a while, many of the governments in the southeast coastal area, and they were so worried that these migrant workers came from inland provinces, went back home to celebrate the Chinese New Year. Like me, they were stuck at home and they couldn't come back. So these local governments in the coastal region actually found ways like renting buses or even airplanes to take these migrant workers back home to restart the business. That happened for quite a while, but very unfortunately, these same manufacturers actually now facing cancellation of export orders. And that's why even though you brought back the migrant workers, you might not actually have jobs for them at the moment. So my own expectation is the economy is already recovering, but this recovery will be slow and very uncertain. In part, it depends on what happened to the rest of the world. I mean, my own expectation is, given that this is a global public health shock, the resumption of business activities around the world and for China to a large extent depends on what happens to the weakest link of the chain. So we just have to be very careful about the outlook.
Alicia, do you want to add some reflections to this first analysis by Professor Yiping?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Yiping. It's very interesting indeed. I fully agree that we can't forget the weakest link of the chain. And as we stand, the West is basically going through that. We can't even confirm that because, maybe the weakest link in the next few weeks will be some parts of the emerging world. So, the weakest link is moving and it's so uncertain. I can't agree more. But because for a long time, we have said, or increasingly so, that China is becoming more self-reliant, meaning domestic demand is more and more important. And moving actually very interestingly and very healthily, I would say, from investment to consumption, it would be nice to see that this hope and actually to a large extent reality, which is this domestic consumption driven domestic demand, plays that role now, which we desperately need. We mean in China and the rest of the world, of course. So for me, the key point is, will we see that? Will the labor market, not only employment, but actual income, be strong enough to make that happen? For me, this is the key question today, because external demand, we know it's going to be poor. We don't know for how long. So my hope is, will we have this consumption-driven growth that we are all hoping for?
Just to add something, if I understand correctly, Alicia, basically what you are saying is that since we cannot rely on worldwide recovery on a fast pace, China should somehow rely on a fast recovery in terms of the demand side internally.
Yeah, it might be harder than, at least in my opinion, given what we've been analyzing, than I would have thought at the beginning. Because, for years we have seen a very fast growth of disposable income, from 10, the latest data was 5.5. Now, the latest March data, real disposable income was -4. To me, frankly speaking, I was very worried about that data point, because I was hoping that disposable income would be put at its best use, meaning now, where, we want to see those retail sales going up. So for me, this is a very important question. Does China need, in other words, consumption-oriented stimulus if this disposable income continues to be so weak? to me, the answer is yes, but at, you know, Yiping Huang is so much more of an expert than me. So I want to push this question to you, Yiping.
Well, I think that's a very good point. What should we expect to drive economic recovery in the coming months if it does happen? And I agree with Alicia completely that consumption is our main hope. So we usually talk about the three key drivers of economic growth: export, investment, and consumption. I think export, as you said, the Chinese economy has been rebalancing since the global financial crisis. The net contribution from export has been actually weakening ever since. So that is not a big surprise, but I'm just saying, on top of that, what some experts expected, once the virus is under control, export can pick up. That becomes very uncertain at the moment. I think the government will also do more in the coming months trying to increase its fixed asset investment. So people talking about, for instance, the so-called high-tech oriented new infrastructure project, and maybe also to develop large major metropolitan areas, urbanization and so on. These are the areas where the government is thinking about spending more money. I think something can happen in the coming months. But my expectation is, in terms of the magnitude, it won't be the same as what we saw during the global financial crisis. So that really leaves the consumption. Now, I think consumption is really the main hope for the future of the Chinese economy. To take a big picture, look at the big picture. I mean, I like to say, in the past, China probably created two global economic stories during the last 40 years. The first global story was exports of labor-intensive manufacturing products, these low-quality, low-value-added, but labor-intensive stuff. That is gone now. The second global story China created was imports of massive commodities from, to support domestic fixed asset investment. Alicia, I'm sure you remember, many countries enjoy the so-called soup cycle of the economy because China increasingly bought more and more commodities. That story is also gradually dying down because growth is slowing and the investment rate is coming down now. I actually think the next global story that China might be able to create is its consumer market. We know that the growth is coming down, but we know the consumption share of GDP has been on the rise after the global financial crisis. Last year, China's retail sales was already greater than that of the U.S. Even though our growth rate is coming down, it might actually be the fastest growing large consumer market in the world. So I am actually hopeful that once we return to normal, this will probably be one of the most exciting stories globally for us to look at. That's a big picture, and I'm optimistic when 1.4 billion people start to spend more on consumption. I think that's something we should all be looking at. And that's a story I think the Chinese entrepreneurs certainly are looking at very closely. And I suspect that international entrepreneurs would also be very excited about that opportunity. But short term, it's a relatively different story. Alicia mentioned consumption was actually pretty weak. What we found during the last couple of months was income was negative, was not growing rapidly, but the consumption actually fell more. That probably reflects the fact that the social security system was somewhat underdeveloped in China. So when economic uncertainties rise, consumers became even more cautious about spending. So their consumption actually declined more than their investment. That's just a fact because our social security system is not well developed. And you look at the government policy, I think one big shift of the fiscal and monetary policy from the last round of the stimulus during the global financial crisis and now the government is spending more on the small, medium enterprises and our ordinary households. But what we do are different from what we saw in other developed and developing countries. For instance, in many other countries, you saw fiscal spending on job retention schemes, unemployment insurance mechanisms, and also directly on cash payout increased significantly. These were not the main items in China, although some local governments start to do similar things. But overall, the government still spend more on fixed asset investment, on tax relief, and on public health. So our money spending is not so much directly channeled to the household's pocket. And I think that's something we just have to keep in mind. So I do think our labor market condition is relatively weak. But fortunately, at the moment, we start to see resumption of economic activities. Once the economic activities are stabilized and the household expectation improve, we probably will see a more a significant rebound of consumption.
So if I may add a follow-up question to understand a little bit better, because you were very clear that there is quite a big investment now on putting money in small medium enterprises, but not too much on households. But in the end of the day, you are speaking about a recovery that will happen if the consumption will resume on the medium term. So how we can combine these two things that they might seem a little bit contradictory? In a first listening to what you're saying, like if the money is being spent on the monetary side, on the financial side, and on keeping the business alive, but not on households who are not going to be able to have the buying power for keeping the consumption going, how do we ensure? Because it seems to me that we can have a problem of supply, like no problem in supply, but a big problem on demand.
Well, it's not exactly that money is not going to the hands of the household. Money is going to the hands of the household, but not in the same way as you see in many developed countries, because we had very little, many limited schemes of like a cash payout. But a lot of local governments are also handing out so-called consumption coupons. The unemployment insurance is accelerating its payment. So I think these are happening. Plus, the Ministry of Finance and the PBOC's policy supporting finance and the reduction of their expenses of the SMEs, also very helpful for maintaining the jobs of the workers and therefore indirectly support consumption. So I actually think the government is also trying to support SMEs and the household, but the way they do it is slightly different, partly because our social security system is just not as well developed as in many other countries. And one big part, but your question is a valid one. I think currently, our unemployment rate might be somewhat underreported because some, for instance, migrant workers, when they lose jobs, they don't have, if they're not protected by social security system, what often happens is they went back home. And that these people will not be recorded in the unemployment number. So I do think we have a big challenge there. But this is kind of like if you walk into a vicious cycle or virtuous cycle. If the economic activities start to stabilize and SMEs start to operate, they will, because they already keep lots of workers and the SMEs provide something like more than 80% of the urban employment, I think activities will restart again. On the other hand, if you look at, for instance, the household balance sheet, they still remain very healthy. The Chinese household probably have among the highest saving in the world. So what they need is not necessarily just the income or cash, but the confidence. Now, that obviously doesn't rule out the possibility that income distribution is unequal. There are lots of people out there need to be supported by some social security system and so on. But I think that there, if you look at the Chinese household balance sheet, overall, it's very different from the ones you see in other advanced countries. Their savings are still very relatively large. So I think confidence will be more important than direct subsidy at this moment.
Alicia, do you want to add something on this point?
Well, first of all, I agree that the fall in real disposable income I was referring to in March doesn't really mean that Chinese can't consume, because, you know, we all know they have excess savings, and this is why still today China holds a current account surplus no matter what, even if we know there are literally billions of people trying to consume or wanting to consume. So it's quite interesting. But having said that, the real question really then is, why aren't they confident to consume? And you may say, well, it's only a question of time. But when you look at even April, PMI data. So let's move, March was bad. Let's move to April. And there still is quite astonishing because, on the service side, you still can't see it. It's just not there. You see much better PMI on the basically real estate related, infra related subsectors. So it's a little bit more the story, as you were saying, the government will be there, fixed asset investment stimulus. That's where I put my hopes. But we still don't see in April data this wonderful consumer we all want to see. So it's taking time. I realize that the world is not helping, because when you watch on the TV what's happening, maybe you just keep your consumption and expectations and just wait. So it may be May. So I just want to see this, this change in mindset of the Chinese consumer. But on top of that, let's imagine it happens. Then for me, the key question I would have, okay, what is it for the rest of the world? Because you said it very clearly, first wave, second wave. The second wave was great. The world was collapsing. China started, importing like crazy for that big stimulus package. Many countries benefited. But now, if the big consumer, the consumption boom comes around, maybe other countries, not the same, will benefit. Okay, it's a different. But will China really, in the current difficult geopolitical circumstances, dare go big on a current account deficit? Because the world has changed a lot. If you have all of these people consuming, will that be foreign goods? I have that query because, many of the people listening to us now are hoping for China to consume. But I just want to give them the right answer. Will this be as much of a big bump for them? Different people, I realize, not commodity exporters, etc. Right. But, luxury goods, you name it. Yeah, many European companies. Will they benefit, or will it be less so than we would have imagined in a different geopolitical environment? That's my question.
Right. My first response to what your observation about very slow or lack of consumer response at the moment, I think that's exactly true. I'm not expecting a quick V-shaped rebound of economic activities. I'm only saying out of the three drivers, probably consumer give us more hope. But if you at the big picture, but obviously if the government start to make a large investment project, we might see more immediate impact. Although I doubt the government will repeat what they did 10, 12 years ago. But the reason why consumer spending is being slow, although I'm confident it's coming, for two reasons at least. Number one, as I said, Very unfortunately, our social welfare system is less developed than in many developed countries. So they are still in the middle of the shock, or even at the toward the end of the shock. You don't expect them just to come out and big spend. It's just a very big uncertain story. The second reason is, even though the PMI is improving, which really means the business is hoping that economic activities will recover very quickly. But you know, employment numbers are lagging in data. So when we start to see consumers feel confident once they get the paycheck and they feel confident about the spending, that will take some time. So I agree with you, and these are some of the reasons why I think it will happen relatively slow this time around. I don't expect like a big rebound of consumption, but I think if anything, consumer might play a greater role than before. That's my first response. The second point is about, well, what will China do given this geopolitical environment? I'm not, as you know, not an expert on the geopolitics. I think what I can say is, in terms of economic policy, it certainly looks like our future growth will have to be somewhat more outward, domestic oriented in terms of growth. Obviously, China still wants to continue to integrate into the rest of the world, but domestic demand is becoming a lot more important, simply because China is a much bigger economy now. It's a large economy, a country economy. You can't just always rely on the same kind of export growth to drive the Chinese economic growth. But I think Chinese consumer will play a role, not just for the Chinese enterprises, but also foreign companies. Now, the key focus, my key story, is actually not about the luxury goods. I think the luxury goods already have happened for more than 10 years now. They've been a leading player in the global market. The next story I'm focusing more on are the ordinary Chinese increasing their spending as their income doubles. So we probably will be looking at more like the relatively high quality products, probably above average, but gradually moving up, not to the very, very high end luxury goods. This is for the mass Chinese market. And once they start to spend, I think we're likely to see a big story there. Final point about your current account. My sense is, you look at Alicia, you've been in Asia for a very long time, and you know most East Asian countries, the economies. Policymakers are probably very cautious about the large current account deficit. And I think with the Chinese policymakers will share the same concern, especially if your financial sector is not completely liberalized, if your exchange rate is not entirely flexible. I think they will be somewhat more cautious about a large current account deficit. But on the other hand, the difference for China compared to many other countries, especially in East Asia, previously experienced from financial crisis, is that China does have a very large foreign exchange reserves. But still, I think they will be cautious about running large current account deficit.
I wanted to have a look. There are quite a lot of questions arriving from the audience, and there is a little bit of a cluster that I will come to in terms of all pointing to a certain direction. Our listeners would like to hear some more insight from your side. To introduce that, you only very quickly mentioned that alongside the quick recovery measures, there are going to be more longer term infrastructure projects, or like things that would, you know, if you're speaking, as you just mentioned, about the objective of even doubling the income of the ordinary Chinese, we're speaking about a massive scale change in the economy, and somehow there has to be growth somewhere in order to allow this, not just small punctual measures. And you mentioned big infrastructure projects, you mentioned urbanization, you mentioned digital, and a lot of our listeners are all kind of asking what kind of role sustainability, climate, environmental objectives would play in this large-scale effort that will be done in order to change basically the way China looks today, if we want to indeed have a consumer market that is totally different from the consumer markets that we have now.
Hmm. Well, I'm not an expert on the climate change story. Recently, our school, National School of Development at the Peking University and the Brookings in Washington, D.C., jointly completed a project called China 2049 and looking at what will be the key challenges facing the Chinese economy over the next 3 decades. Climate change was one of the issues that we will have to deal with. My understanding from our team members working on that in that area certainly was confident that China is moving in that direction, make a bigger commitment, sign the Paris Agreement, and so on. But just broadly, as just a non-expert view, I think this actually is consistent with what we are seeing in the transition of the economic structure in China. The Chinese economy, you look at, for instance, after the global financial crisis, a lot of structure changes happened. Number one, as we said earlier on, the Chinese economy was rebalancing. The current account surplus actually came down quite significantly. Investment rate is coming down. Consumption ratio is rising. And one other big change is actually now the service sector is becoming more important. We probably reached the peak of the share of manufacturing industry in the GDP in around 2012. So I think these changes plus the consumption-oriented economy is actually in line with a more environmental friendly and a climate more sustainable environment. So I think that actually is consistent. Now, longer term, we are not talking about income growth mainly driven by government policies. We're mainly thinking about more organic growth driven by productivity. One big area you quickly mentioned, which is really seeing momentum at the moment in China, is what we call the digital economy. The economic activities relying on digital technology. So for instance, e-commerce is one big player in China. At the moment, the e-commerce already accounted for more than one quarter of the total retail sales in China. That was one of the reasons actually the households found it a little bit better, easier to cope with the lockdown, because you can just pick up the phone and make the order online and the products will be delivered to your home. As I mentioned, I've been in Hong Kong for the past 3-4 months, but our teaching continues. So I think these are actually having a big impact on economic activity, plus what I call macroeconomic stabilizer during the COVID-19 outbreak. It helped to mitigate some of the negative impact. Another big story is that what we call, you mentioned that at the beginning, I'm heading this Institute of Digital Finance in China. One of the biggest problems during this outbreak of COVID-19 was the central bank, the government, and the financial institutions all know that they needed to support the SMEs in order to support the social stability, economic stability. The question is how to reach the SMEs. In fact, we found in the end, what was most effective was through these so-called online banks. So for instance, the WeBank set up by Tencent, the My Bank set up by Alibaba, and there's another bank, XW Bank. They continue to support the SMEs for two reasons. Number one, these customers, you don't need to meet them in face-to-face in order to extend the loans. Number two, you use the big database, the credit risk assessment models. You don't need the fixed assets to look at to use as the collaterals. So I do think this is the one bright spot of the Chinese economy. Just to summarize, I think there are a lot of bright spots in the Chinese economy at the moment and probably in the coming years. Number one is consumer spending, and number two is the digital economy.
Just a follow-up question from the audience about the issue on climate, because you mentioned that even if you are not climate expert, this is going to be something that is taken into consideration. There is a precise question from Mark here in Brussels, who says, who asks if, in your knowledge, do any public stimuli include a climate-oriented conditioning in disbursing money to projects?
I really have no knowledge about that, because these new packages at the moment are still in the discussion. But the government is serious about achieving these commitments about the specific target. I forgot, but if there is a big stimulus, my own understanding is certainly they should not compromise the commitment already made. But as I said, I have no knowledge about the specific condition for the stimulus package.
Thank you. Alicia, do you want to add something on this point before we go to our last round of questions from the audience and then we wrap up?
You mean on climate change? Or
I mean these relations between the, let's say, moving from the immediate recovery plan to the more longer term investment that there is going to be made in the economy, and what are the consequences for both the internal consumption and the global value chains, because that's also the question you were asking before.
About value chains later, because I'm sure this deserves, you know, some comments from Yiping.
Yes, so indeed. That's why I wanted to introduce and make a bridge on that.
Yes, I'm going to wait for that one. But I do want to make a comment, which is just a logical takeaway of Yiping's answer to the question, will China offer more out of its 1.3 billion consumers to the rest of the world? And the answer, which I fully agree with, is surely, but remember, we're bigger. Remember, naturally, and this is true for the US, you know, will be less of an external demand story, not only on the export, but also on the import. And this also means that because the rest of the world, the external demand for China, China's exports, will be very weak for quite some time, if China is not ready to suddenly switch from a current account surplus to a rather substantial deficit whatsoever, and I can't agree more, this means that the world can't rely on a very large demand from China's side. I just want to make that point very explicit to our listeners, because that's, in my opinion, the reality of things. And I want this to be very clear. It's not going to be a new, put it this way, red pocket, maybe to you know, for the world. It's not going to be. I'm not saying this is right or wrong. Maybe I would do the same if I were China, because, you know, it's hard times for everybody. But this brings us closer to Great Depression type scenarios. And you may say I'm pushing the argument too much. I'm not saying China starts this, because China is not having the external demand from the rest of the world either. But in a way, because everybody's trying to keep that domestic consumer, for whatever it's worth, in the case of China, for a lot, for others, less so, because Europe has an even bigger car count surplus, let's face it. You know, it eventually, this seem to me, this holds up to less and less demand, for everybody. And I could push the argument looking at Chinese, by the way, prices, which are very telling, you know, very, to me, very worrisome, because we are seeing, although CPI is still high, coming down, producer prices already negative, deflationary prices coming from the rest of the world. You know, I worry about this. In other words, I worry about everybody saying, this consumer is mine, in a nutshell. And I just wanted to, you know, push. I'm not saying you said that, but there's a risk, basically. There's a risk that everybody thinks the only thing I have left is my own consumer. China has a great time to say that, because it has very many with huge savings, you know, so you're lucky, but others are less lucky. And overall, I think this is right. A key issue for the global economy. That's what I wanted to point out.
Well, can I add just the 2 points to your observation? Number one is, when I said the Chinese policymakers would be reluctant to run large current account deficit, I was more referring to continue the persistent large current account deficit. And I can't rule out the possibility of, in 1 year or 2 years, you suddenly have a large current account deficit. Unusual times. That's the one thing I think I want to make sure it's different. The second point, obviously, I think you're right. If the global pandemic situation is not stable, then, well, demand for Chinese exports would be weak. But at the same time, Alicia, I'm sure you would agree, even if China wants to buy more from the rest of the world, they might not be in the position to produce and supply that. So I think we need to distinguish the two different time periods. Number one, the next year or maybe half year or year or maybe two, we don't know, depending on the situation of the pandemic, the recovery period. The more optimistic story I was trying to tell was more on medium to longer term.
Yes, absolutely. Fully agree.
And going to the other issue, because we just mentioned in terms of global impact, what is going to happen. The other big story there, I mean, which we started to mention it a little bit before and just a few seconds ago, it's the global value chain disruption. And I have another clusters of questions that, you know, there was quite a lot of questions on climate that there are quite a few questions on the global value chains, especially they all point out to the challenge. On one hand, as you mentioned, the uncertainty that we are living in terms of the COVID pandemic and eventually what's going to be next in the health crisis, and if there is going to be a second wave, we are uncertain on the consequences on the global system of this. And this happens in a moment where also there is this geopolitical situation where there are tensions in the way global value chains will be structured normally, and trying to break down some of the usual cooperation patterns that we used to see. If you look at these two elements, this make pretty serious situation to be considered in the medium to long term. How do you see, first of all, these two things in being interrelated or not being interrelated, and how this should be taken into account when there is a strategy towards the recovery of the Chinese economy vis-a-vis the global economy?
Well, about the supply chain or the value chain, my own view is somewhat more upbeat or confident compared to some experts. During the pandemic, or even before that, you heard people talking about the shifting the supply chain, the production facilities away from China. I think that happened, number one, for political reasons. I probably should leave that geopolitical implication for Alicia to comment. I'm not really an expert, but I see why people feel nervous. The second reason was also the relative, the comparative advantage of the Chinese economy is gradually shifting. So shifting out of the manufacturing facilities in, from China was not a new story. It's been happening. In fact, that's the reason why China has been successful. If China is still producing what it produced 30 years ago, then it's a very backward economy today. So that's not a big surprise to me. The real question is now, are we going to see the leaving of majority of the supply chain from China to do it elsewhere? I'm very much doubtful for a number of reasons. Number one, if you look at the whole supply chain, you probably see the most complete set inside China. If you want to move it somewhere, my first question is where you're going to move to. Because the place you needed to move to, you needed to have the technology, you needed to have the skilled workers, and you needed to have the similar kind of cost basis. And we saw some other countries taking up some manufacturing facilities, but it's actually quite difficult. I mean, from an economist observation, just to move them out and back to the US, I really doubt. If you really want to move one workshop of face mask production back to Japan or the US, that might be possible. But if you really want to move the entire supply chain back with, as I said, the skilled workers, the cost base, and the technology, it's probably very difficult. That's the first point. The second point is, well, as I said, supply chain needs to look at where your market is. And over the coming decade or two, my own sense is the biggest and the most dynamic consumer market is in China, not elsewhere. That's something we need to keep in mind. Number three, well, at the beginning of the pandemic, people talking about, well, maybe we needed to diversify the supply chain because the risks could come. That, I think, is a very valid point. The usual saying of not putting all of your eggs in one basket, and I think that's something people will probably think about. But across the world at the moment, if you think things like a pandemic might come back again, if you want to find a place where the risks might be controlled most quickly and most effectively, which country do you guess? So I'm not too pessimistic. I think that business decisions will all happen, and the comparative advantage of the Chinese economy has been changing always. I will not be surprised some relocation would happen. But by and large, I think a majority of the supply chains will stay in China.
I have a follow-up question to Alicia on this. Like from your perspective, how do we make this work for everyone? Like, how can we make this back to a win-win situation at a global level, given this uncertainty and given these circumstances?
I think, first of all, in essence, I agree with the idea that China is too big to ignore. China's market is too important. People are not going to just say, I leave it. And, you know, this is obvious. However, and this is, to me, very important, China's size of the global value chain, it's actually much bigger than its GDP size. I mean, so let's say we're talking about 15% of global GDP. China's trade in intermediate goods, so the share of the value chain in through, you know, using OECD input output statistics is 32. So it's double. Why is it double? Because China is not only serving its own market, it's serving other markets. And of course, I don't mean to say that everything that is not serving China's market will leave, because probably there's a lot of vertical integration yeah, by which it's just too costly, as you said. Even if wages have come up, I mean, today Malaysia is cheaper than China, average wages. So, you know, there's many places in the world today, supposedly kind of middle income type emerging economy, that are cheaper than China. Just their ports are not as efficient. So, you know, when you think about the whole cost structure, maybe still it pays off to remain in China. However, it becomes increasingly complicated as the components of that value chain may be affected by geopolitical considerations. So just as an example, for national security reasons, and this is a rather recent law in China, you may have to basically keep all of everything you do in the cloud in China. So basically, no information outside, as long as you operate in China. So, you know, and this, as long as it serves the Chinese market, there's no way out. But maybe the minute you start thinking it may serve a third market, you may have to look at the consequences of that decision, let alone what I think is going to be rather permanent, even I would argue with a different US government, which is mainly increasing tariffs, because we are seeing a massive deglobalization of trade as we speak. So in essence, what I'm trying to say here is that China's centricity, maybe I would use that word, in the global value chain may be reduced, which doesn't mean that China won't be huge. It just means that it won't be as central. There may be two or three or four different regional centers to which key economies will jump on just to diversify, as you said, and reduce that kind of systemic, sometimes geopolitical, sometimes even not geopolitical, sometimes it may be physical risk. Think about the earthquakes in Thailand years ago and Toyota's decision not to depend too much on Thailand. That wasn't geopolitical, but it was climate change, if you may say, related. So all of that pushes companies to have different sites and to integrate vertically beyond one single center. So I think what will change is China's centricity, which doesn't mean China won't be relevant, very relevant, for one ecosystem. But there may be other ecosystems. So this is my thinking about how these things may evolve.
Yiping, do you want to comment on this?
Well, no, I agree. Number one, as I said at the very beginning, I would leave geopolitics-related issues to Alicia to comment. I'm not an expert, but I do agree some diversification will probably happen for political, economic, or even physical reasons Alicia mentioned earlier. Plus, I think, as I said, China's own comparative advantage is gradually shifting. It's moving more toward service-oriented economy. So I'm not surprised. I'm just saying, because just the argument that because of the pandemic, we will see all the supply chains moving away, that is probably overblown. And as I said, if you look at the effectiveness of controlling the pandemic, there is more reason for you to stay in China than moving out of China. But otherwise, I agree on all the points, the cautions that Alicia mentioned.
Thank you, Yiping. We are really going towards the end of this episode, because we could go on and discuss for hours and hours about this. And obviously, this is not a discussion that we're going to finish right here, right now, because we are going to continue this conversation. Alicia, do you want to say some last words from your side? You have some final comments?
I think my takeaway of this conversation is that we should be patient. This is very Chinese, you know. We should be patient. We should give China time to show its way to the recovery. First of all, because we will need that time in the West, maybe even longer. So you know, when I get anxious about this retail sales or disposable income, I should apply this Nixing, you know, wait and see. especially because China, and in my humble opinion, rightly so, has decided not to go big bang on the stimulus. And there's debt considerations, there's lots of things that I think justify that. On perhaps the final point to be made is the long term. So I agree with this idea that China will become kind of more balanced. Yeah, I mean, service, maybe why should China have 32% of intermediate goods trade? I mean, in a way, it puts even China in too much on the spotlight, if I may say, too much on the spotlight. So in that regard, that is a positive development for China in the medium term. Take this opportunity to be less on the spotlight in certain issues. But the optimism on the long run, to me, boils down to this bet, which is a bet that I share, i.e. innovation-driven growth, long-term productivity happening. And I don't have an answer, you know, meaning what's the bar for success? Because China is becoming a developed economy, so we can't think of China growing 5% forever or even 4%. What's the bar? I mean, this is the conversation. We need one more
podcast. Yeah, one more podcast.
But I think that is a key issue. That is a key issue. Set the bar at the right level, not too high, not too low, and how to get there, how to get China's productivity aligned with that ultimate objective. So I think this is how, for me, I can measure success, if I may say so, down the road. And I don't have an answer, but I think it's a very important question for China.
And Yiping, your last comments and reflections.
Okay. Well, my main takeaway or my main message is that this time is different from previous crises we saw. So I'm thinking about China replaying what it did 10, 12 years ago or 20 years ago would probably not be correct. But as I said, China will come out probably in a different way from this recession, this crisis. But we'll also see some bright spots I mentioned about the consumer spending, about the digital economy, and so on. Now, the last point I actually want to share with you, as a Chinese economist, we also worried about what is going to happen to the world economy after this pandemic is controlled. Two things that always come to my mind. The number one is, if this pandemic would really lead to acceleration of deglobalization, that will be very bad for China. We were talking about partial decoupling between China and the US before this pandemic shock. Is this partial going to be more higher degree going forward or less? We don't know, but that's something that will really affect our future, because even though, as we said, the Chinese economy probably will become more domestic demand-oriented going forward, nevertheless, global environment will still be critical for China going forward. The second worry is about the possible exit of the excessively loose monetary and fiscal policies. Now, I have no opposition to the so-called whatever it takes policy, all countries adopting in fighting against this COVID-19. I think they deserve to do that. These were the right policy actions. The only concern, the question is when and how they're going to exit these very high public debt and very loose liquidity conditions. There is a small risk, maybe not too small, that they will never exit. If they never exit from these excessive policies, then it is going to affect the outside environment for the Chinese economy. That's something I also worry quite a bit. Thank you,
Professor Yiping. And as we said, this is not a conversation that should stop now. We continue to monitor from Bruegel's side, especially with the contributions of Alicia and other scholars, to the analysis of what is going on in relations to the Chinese economy, but the Asian markets in general, and also the relations between Europe and the rest of the world. So I would like to thank once again you to join us, and for sure we hope that you will join The Sound of Economics also some other time in order to continue this conversation with us. And also thank to our listeners who have been active in asking questions and to follow our conversation. And for them, I would like to remind that all our analysis and papers and publications are all available on our website, www.bruegel.org. Until next time, I would say bye-bye.